Thursday Night Tailgate, where the spotlight is always on the positive. Tune in Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time to hear your favorite NFL legends, players, and coaches sharing their stories. Now back to Chris and Bob.
I wouldn't joke about anything else that happened to you tonight.
All right, now back with us here on Thursday Night Tailgate is former Steelers Pro Bowl defensive back JT Thomas.
How you guys been doing?
No, excellent. We're fantastic. JT, how about you? What's been going on with you? Catch us up.
I've been in the restaurant business, as you know, most of my career, and now I'm in a coffee business for the last few years, so with a company called Crazy Mocha. And I'm franchising coffee beans, I guess, for lack of a better word.
So, JT, I want to start our time with you tonight by getting your thoughts, going back to your time at Florida State and taking a look ahead to this upcoming season for FSU. And they finished 7-6 last season, 3-5 in the ACC. They've got a new head coach in Willie Taggart. I'm curious to get your thoughts. Are you excited to see him take over the program? Are you cautiously optimistic about this season? Or are you going to wait and see, in wait-and-see mode? How do you feel about the Seminoles in this upcoming season?
Well, you know, we have a bunch of guys that we on the internet actually communicating a lot, and very excited about Willie coming in. I think he's been embraced, and he brings an attitude and a culture, and I think it was time for a change. So we're very excited. After last year, Jimbo, he had a great run there, but sometimes change is good, and I think he will bring a new flavor, a new attitude, and like I say, we're in a new generation of young men in athletics, and I think his timing is really impeccable, really. Yeah.
So, JT, in order to feel, kind of good about the season, do you have sort of a high water mark that you're looking at saying, if they win 7 games this year, they win 8 games, 9 games, what's your expectation? Where do they got to get to in order to feel good about this season?
If they had 500, I think that would be good. I'm sure now they're expecting better than that, but you make a transition of a culture that's been there, even go back to Bobby before Jimbo, that was kind of just passing the baton. So you're really making a huge culture shift there. And can you make it in a season? I don't think so. I think if they come out at 500 this year, I think that's a win. Now, granted, I'm a big fan, going down for homecoming, and I like to see them, win 8 this year. And again, but if I'm not a gambler, but if I was a gambler, I would give them, they'll play at 500 this year, definitely.
So, regardless of the record, right? The Florida State game. If they come out with a win over Florida, does that make a successful
that's a
season?
Victory.
Like, look, win that game.
That's a winning season. I was there my 4 years, and I never, we never beat Florida. We never did. And we had some great seasons out there. We never had a losing season, but I was never able to, carve me a gator and fry them up and make a, gator, desserts or appetizer out of it. No.
Five questions for JT.
It's great to speak to you again, JT, and we're at the point now where teams are going back to training camp, and I want to talk about your first training camp. Here you are. You were the first-round draft pick, 73, Latrobe, Pennsylvania. Take me back, JT, your memories when you first arrived there.
Well, when I first arrived there, obviously, you kind of enthralled. You don't know what to expect. You're young. But what really was the Steelers had only won their first winning season prior to that, Franco's and Mack reception. So really, I'm coming in on the second season of that first winning season in 40 years. The biggest intimidating factor there was the tempo. I was getting run over by LC Greenwood. He was saying, "Hey, get out of the way," and I wasn't accustomed to defensive ends and linebackers running up my butt. So I had to adjust to the tempo there. But what I really, remember, most of all, it was strictly a survival training camp. It was a process of elimination. And, we had 4 weeks of tour days. I would lose 6 pounds in the morning and I would drop another 7-8 in the afternoon. So it was, probably the worst thing in my life was training camp. And it never subsided. You never got accustomed to it because Chuck Noll's training camp was, you come there, everyone was a rookie, I think, except Joe Green. I think every other guy was thinking I'd make it cut.
And you had a pretty good year. I mean, get into all the games that year, JT. You learned the system. You actually picked off a pass. I'm wondering if you remember that first career interception against two, and when did it happen?
No, I don't remember the first one, but I do remember that first season because they had brought me in to replace a great cornerback, John Lauser, who had played under Vince Lombardi. So, and I'm here taking John's job, and John knew that, but John was my greatest fan, my biggest support, and I learned more from John than anyone, because you can understand the number one draft choice who played corner and safety. You know, my friend, homeboy, Mel Blount, you know, they kind of said hi and bye, and Glenn Edwards, Mike Wagner, you know, you bring a number one in, you know, so where he's going to play, whose job he's going to take. But John knew I was brought in to, you know, really to replace him. And, but he really taught me more, and really, it wasn't for John, I probably wouldn't actually adjusted as quick as I did, because he had played under Lombardi, and John knew stuff that even our great defensive coordinator, Bud Carson, didn't know about the game. It was just amazing, his knowledge of the game, and it kind of catapulted me. Even Bud asked me, Carson asked me once, you know, I said, I guess in the interview, I said I had learned a lot from John Rouser, and walking in one day, Bud asked me, you say you learned a lot from John. What did John teach you? You know? So he was probing me. Because John had the wisdom about the game that was just impeccable, really. And so it was a great year, but I knew I was coming in to play. And Chuck Knowles had indicated that when he drafted me, he said this. I thought he was just talking crap. He said, you know, we're about one player from the Super Bowl, and they say we get one defensive back, we can win. And I said, yeah, you know, well, you tell all your number one draft choice that. But when I look back, I guess that's what happened. Because I was only new face on the defense, really.
And JT, you mentioned Elsie Greenwood, and we were blessed to have Elsie on the show a few times before we lost him.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the story about he and Joe Green, you know, how they would sit in the meeting rooms and the coaches would be up there going over the film and drawing things up and doing the X's and the O's, and that, you know, the two of them didn't pay any attention to that stuff. Elsie said football's an easy game. See the football, tackle the guy with the football. None of that other stuff makes any difference. Is that consistent with what you remember about being in
that. Maybe when Chuck was coming in, and Chuck was normally adding tidbits, but these guys were very much knowledgeable of the game with George Perlis. George Perlis was a great coach, kind of an intimidating type coach, but he was fun loving, and these guys were very smart. They knew the game very well. As you notice, a lot of the rule changes came out of, you know, matter of fact, when they took out the head slap and the bump and run rule, I think Chuck was there upset in the meeting. And I was told that Chuck walked out because most of the rule change and the film clipping were the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Oakland Raiders. And Chuck said, well, what is this? And Pete Rozelle said, you know, it's not a good thing for Pittsburgh to be in the Super Bowl every year. It's bad for business. So those front four had mastered the head slap. And, you know, obviously Deacon Jones, those guys back, was mastered at it also. But those four guys were very good. And also the bump and run. We played a lot of bump and run, and so basically, those rule changes were made by great players, but also great coaches was a part of that too.
And JT, our good friend and former Patriots power running back Tony Collins told the story to us about seeing Jack Lambert smoking cigarettes in the locker room before the game and at halftime of the Pro Bowl that he played in. And that's not the first time that we've heard that story. Was that true? Did you see a lot of that?
Well, yeah. You know, let me tell you something, and this is probably, I blow a lot of people's mind about this. Our culture was smoking. Matter of fact, and it's still a locker room. Every locker had a ashtray on it. And day of the game. Now, I was a pipe smoker. I had 100 pipes, so I smoked pipes. But the day of the game, guys are getting dressed for games. Bradshaw had a cigar, rocked a cigarette. John Stallworth was a chain smoker. At halftime, Matter of fact, the entire front four smoked. At halftime, you would have the front four smoking cigarettes while we make an adjustment. Coach is smoking. Jack Lamb would have two. He had one in his mouth and one behind his ear. And obviously, I couldn't light my pipe up because that would have been too cool, you know, at halftime smoking a pipe. But no, but that was the culture. It was. And now, obviously, they don't smoke him, but it was just part of the culture. It was very natural to smoke before the game, after the game. But I think we had a rule in our playbook that if smoking affects your performance, obviously you shouldn't smoke. But I think Chuck was aware of that. But our conditioning level was so, I mean, off the chain and gruesome. You know, but then I wonder if we had not smoked, what we would have done.
Bobby, more for JT?
JT, I was wondering, I know you played cornerback, and also you did a little work at safety, and I was wondering,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think a very talented defensive back in any era, JT, can effectively go between the two positions, or is it too specialized these days?
I think a cornerback can go to safety. I don't think too many safeties can go to cornerback. And understand, I have played in college. I played both cornerback and safety. And I got thrown in the safety when Mike Wagner was hurt, and I was the guy. You know, I guess on a Monday Night Football, I got kind of thrown into the game. Yeah, I think a cornerback can. Yeah, you know, you had a guy like Rod Woodson, another great cornerback. That also went into safety. So for a cornerback, it's easier because he's not on the aisle. It's not the same pressure. And so basically, yeah, I think the transition for a cornerback is pretty easy, you know.
And finally, JT, I mean, after the magical run in Pittsburgh, you spent your last season in Denver. That was the Joe Collier defenses of that day. In Denver, did you go out under your own terms? Did you feel comfortable spending that last year in Denver? Talk to us about that final season.
No, well, I mean, in Denver I was fine. I mean, I was kind of shocked when I was traded from Pittsburgh. I was shocked because basically, you know, if you're beaten out, that's one thing. But I think the fact that you have to go back a few years before that, Ron Johnson came in. And one year I was sick. I had sarcoidosis. And Ron came in. And the year I came back, you know, they drafted Ron primarily to fill my void. And what people don't know, Ron was on the draft list of the Steelers, but he wasn't the number one draft choice. I had a gag on that year. I knew the year before we were going to Denver to play, and I found out you know, I had this flare-up, and I found out I probably would play in the following year. So I had a gag on not to say, even off season, not to, you know, mention that I wasn't going to play by the Steelers. And the Steelers had indicated, well, don't say anything because, we don't want you to. But we'll pay your contract. And if you don't come back able to play, what we'll do, we will give you a job in the front office. So what happened, I found out that year I was off, doing with the scouting department that year. Ron was targeted for like a fifth round safety, but when I got sick and they had to replace me, Johnson moved up to the number one spot. And so actually, you can understand the guys in the secondary saying, what the heck are we drafting a number one DB? I know Mel thought he was getting traded, Mike Wagner, Glenn Eric was done. He said, what the, you know, Donnie Shell. And I knew, and I felt bad that whole offseason, not being able to tell them that I wasn't going to play and they wouldn't be traded. But the problem, when I returned that year, I got my job back. And there were just too many guys after Super Bowl 14 in the secondary, and I'm obviously looking for more money on the contract situation. And so I was, expendable. And it was tough because I wanted to retire here. And the reason I was, traded was never justified. You know, traded to Denver because it never materialized. That's the reason why. You know, this is why, you know, Chuck told me, I never forget this. The only time Chuck never looked in my eyes is when I always stare in your eyes. He was looking down, talking to me, during the whole process as, you know, about this opportunity for me, et cetera, you know, that I was being pressured somewhat in the defense, and it never looked so I knew then, you know, that was part of, you know, the game of politics and of sports and the money situation too. But Denver was great because I think going to Denver, I got a new perspective about life, and I was kind of prepared myself more so for retirement, you know. And I think by going to Denver, I saw some things there with some of the players that they were doing that really kind of triggered my interest in the restaurant industry. So I ended up, you know, when I did retire, I went from a Chinese restaurant to Burger King to doing Applebee's about 20-some-odd years. At Applebee's, they were grilling more restaurants. So if I hadn't gone to Denver, I don't think I would have gotten into the restaurant industry. So I like Denver.
JT, getting back to, you know, leading up to the trade or being traded, did that impact your relationship with the organization after you left and after you retired? Or how is the relationship now with the organization?
I tell you what, you know, it was very interesting. The year I came back and retired from Denver, they were honoring Chuck Noll as at the Dapper Dan here. And I walked into the reception there prior to the banquet, and Chuck saw me, and you know, his eyes had a gleam and a glow, kind of reluctant, not knowing what I was going to say. So I went over and I hugged him. I said, "What happened, Jazzy Chaz?" And obviously, I think what happened at that time, and more so when he gave his presentation, he included me in his presentation. So I think at that point in time there was some, relief, and he felt relief that the trade had not, dampened the relationship, because I know damn well he had not planned to put me in his speech. He didn't know I was coming, I don't think, to this thing. And, you know, and obviously once you're a stealer, you're a stealer for the most part, you know. No, it did not dampen that relationship at all. Matter of fact, it's just one of those things that you're part of the family. And I think, it was a sad thing, you know, that I left for. But even Franco, you know, he got traded. He went to Seattle. I don't think any of our guys, on that team actually, only a few of them retired on the, even LC Greenwood. I mean, he left here, his last photo was with a shoebox in his hand. But, you know, I think what happened, I know what happened. During that time, I think the Steelers, Dan Rooney admitted that, you know, when they traded guys the way they did, they made a mistake because they thought that it would continue. So when Bill Cowher came in, that was an effort to get those guys back because they cut them all off. Most guys from that era really for a few years had nothing to do with the team. So when Bill Cowher came in, they had this, dinner with all the new rookies. And what they would do, their draft, rookie draft team of that year, they would have dinner with all the vets, and they would invite the vets from my era. Case in point, myself, Mel Blount, Donnie Shell, we would eat with all the defensive backs. So by position, they brought these players back in, and what, they admitted that they thought that their tradition would just, you know, perpetuate itself, but it didn't. So all those players came back and were actually reunited through that process and really re-engaged. And they have kept us engaged since that time.
JT, looking ahead to this coming season, you know, most of the questions around the Steelers are really centered around the defense, in particular the linebackers and the defensive backs. Do you think that they have the defensive talent that they plug the gap that they needed to plug? Because obviously that the way the season ended last year against Jacksonville has left a sour taste, I think, in every Steelers fan.
Well, I think for the last 6 or 7 years, if you go back even to Paul Amalo, I think where they lack the ability to go all the way is in the secondary. When you look at a defensive ball club, I mean, you can pick the Super Bowl every year. There's a prototype, outline that you need to win. In order to win a Super Bowl offensively, you have to have at least 2 all-pro caliber wide receivers on offense. You have to have an all-pro quarterback and 1 all-pro running back. Defensively, you must have a front 4 or a front 7 that can control the line of scrimmage, and you must have 2 all-pro caliber defensive backs in the secondary. And if you go and look at all the teams that win for the last 50-some-odd years, for the most part, you see that. You know, and you look at the Steelers, they have the offensive team to win. They have the all four wide receivers. They may have three. They have the quarterback and the running back. What they don't have, and haven't had in a few years, is that front four, that seven, to control the line of scrimmage, and they haven't had those two all-pro defensive backs, be it a cornerback, safety, or you must have that. And if you take that template, most Super Bowls can be picked on that. Matter of fact, that's how I've been picking them for the last, you know, 30-something years. too bad I don't bet. A gambler, I would own the city of Pittsburgh. Yeah, so I think the Steelers have not filled the gap in the secondary. And it's been that way for even when you had Paul Marlon and Ike Taylor, you still didn't have. I think the last secondary that had that ingredients were Cornell Lake and Rod Woodson, and they haven't had that since that time. So yeah, I think it's going to be very tough unless they fill that the linebacker or lineman, where they can actually control the line of scrimmage, and they get two all-pro guys that they really can shut down a few people, be it a wide receiver or a tight end.
JT, over the last week or so, we've heard stuff come from James Harrison talking about Mike Tomlin. You know, he isn't disciplined enough with the team, and that's the gap between the Steelers and the Patriots. You know, and from a distance, as a Steelers fan, I may tend to agree with him. It sort of looks that way. But your thoughts, do you think that's the case? Or do you think it's just sour grapes from Harrison?
No, Mike is a quasi throwback, to the old era. But at the same time, he's dealing with this millennium mindset. And I think the head coach role today is a little different. You're not only a head coach leader, but you have to be almost almost friendly with them. And I'm not saying you be unfriendly, but I think it's a tough balancing act. And I think he does a great job, where he can actually communicate with them yet command their respect. And he does. Now, James Harrison could be, it could be sour grapes with him. I'm not sure what the case is. But I don't think that's the case. But I think the role of the head coach has changed from the time for all head coaches, except probably in New England. I think there's only one team that I would think is a real throwback team. That's why they're winning, New England. I think Belichick controls every aspect of the game. Okay. When I was playing, the head coach runs the show. I don't think the head coach today's job is to run the show. I think what he does is to make sure the guys are quasi happy and productive. Because if in my day, if a guy screwed up, Bradshaw, Franco, you get jerked out the game. Today, I think the front office, and it's JT Thomas' perspective, runs the game, because if I got a guy up that I'm paying $30-40 million, I can't take him off the game. And I think because of that, guys not afraid to be taken out. Mel Blunt was yanked out on national TV in our first championship game against Oakland Raiders because he wasn't covering Cliff Branch as well on national TV. And Mel was upset about it. And I never forget, Bud Carson and I was in New Orleans at the Super Bowl, and Mel was telling the media he was upset about it. And Bud Carson, came up to us and said, "Well, Mel, you know what? If you screw up again in the Super Bowl, we say I yank your ass again." So I think you don't have that today. So I think because the money has changed, the control and who plays. And I don't think the guys feel threatened because, I can get beat, 6-7 times and go to the Pro Bowl. When I was playing, if you gave them 3 touchdowns a year, that was the limit. Chuck, you was thinking you may be traded, or he'll ask you, "Can you play in this league? Can you play for us if you give up 3 touchdowns?" So that was the limit. So it's a different game now, I think. And I think the economics kind of dictated more so than the head coach does with the player. So he has, it's a balancing act there. You know, you got a player making more than the coach. And, can I bench him? No, because it's a marketing thing today. So the money has changed the game from that respect. Yeah.
JT, before we let you go, now you reminded us that, you know, you're in the coffee business now with Crazy Mocha. How can our listeners find out more information about the coffee business you're in and keep track of what you're doing, whether it's online or over social media?
Well, it's two ways. You can go to Facebook, obviously, Crazy Mocha, and type in Crazy Mocha Hill District, because I'm in the Hill District of Pittsburgh. Okay, and we're located there, Crazy Mocha, the Hill District, and find out what's going on. And you can go to my Facebook page and find out what's going on with me. Yeah.
Well, JT, we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come back and be a part of the show. So many things, Bob and I would love to get your thoughts and insights
Definitely.
On, plus more of your memories from being a part of the Steelers organization. We hope you'll come back and do it again soon. You're fantastic.
Feel free to call me.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate that very much. JT, take care. All the best to you and your family. We look forward
thank
to having you.
You
back on again soon.
Take care.
Thank you, buddy. Good night.
That is former Steelers Pro Bowl defensive back JT Thomas. And Bob, obviously we got so many, you know, stories and things that happened with that wonderful Steelers organization from the, you know, winning those Super Bowls, and Craig Colquitt about to join us, talk about more of those from his perspective as well. But boy, it sure is wonderful having JT as part of the show.
Yeah, and we have a lot of good things as far as the coaching. The way it's so much different. I think you made a great point with the millennial mindset. That's pretty cool, Chris. But we can pick his brain more about that and about his ex-teammates and et cetera the next time he comes on. That was a lot of fun.
All right. Like I say, we've got our next guest, Craig Colquitt, hanging on the line. We're going to get to Craig on the other side of these words about Double Back Winery.